Good evening. Welcome everyone to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Matt and I'm an alcoholic.
Matt.
For those of us who care to join us, let's open the meeting with the Serenity Prayer. God.
God.
Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen.
The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively. They are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving about the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. I will now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open Big Book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the steps discussed tonight. This evening, we are discussing steps 8 and 9. Please welcome our panel. This evening, we have Lynn and David. I will read the first paragraph on page 80, and then the panel will share for a few minutes each on the reading. All right, so on page 80, we begin with, the chances are we have domestic troubles. Perhaps we are mixed up with women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. We doubt if, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. But drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with an alcoholic, a wife gets worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative. How could she be anything else? The husband begins to feel lonely and sorry for himself. He commences to look around in the nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. Perhaps he is having a secret and exciting affair with the girl who understands. In fairness, we must say that she may understand, but what are we going to do about a thing like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he is married to a loyal and courageous girl who has literally gone through hell for him.
Okay. You want me to start out?
It's your choice. Lady's choice.
Oh, okay. Why don't you start out? I just couldn't remember if I spoke what I was supposed to say.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is David.
Okay.
Hi, David.
I'm grateful to be here and grateful to be sober tonight. I have a sobriety date. It's October 24th, 1989. I was 28 years old when I got sober. If I live till February, I'll be 58 years old. I have a sponsor. My sponsor is aware that he sponsors me. It's not a theoretical relationship. I have the privilege of sponsoring other men, and I have a home group at Simple Actions, where we all are tonight on this chilly evening. I looked at the paragraphs last week knowing I was going to have to talk, and I thought, oh man, why did I pick this? These particular paragraphs, these amends within the context of the family, and it really is some of the deepest shame that I carry. Obviously, this little paragraph has to do with cheating on your spouse. I didn't have a lot of that trouble. It didn't count when I was drinking. I think about, there's two things I think about in here. I think about, you know, one of the benefits of being sober for a while, by the way, is that you get to do selfish and inconsiderate things without being able to blame it on alcohol. So, you know, you got that to look forward to. When I think of the loyal and courageous girl that literally went through hell for me, we spent our 21st birthdays together. She was there when I checked into detox at age 22 and met you guys for the very first time. She was there for the next year where I remained bone dry without the benefit of 12 steps in recovery. So I was a party to be around. You know, that poor thing, she couldn't walk across the room without me having something to say about the way that she was walking across the room. You know, you think you're better than me, don't you? You know, I'm just picking fights constantly. And then she was there for the inevitable return to drinking and the chaos that ensued there. I was capable of, I was going to say at the end of my drinking, but really from the time I started drinking, you really didn't know if you were going to get Happy David, Lovey David, Cuddly David, Jokey David, or Raging, Violent, Break Stuff, Yell at You David. And that was true the whole way. And she got to bear a lot of that. I got to watch her go to work one morning with big Jackie O sunglasses to cover the black eyes that she had received during the evening. I take no pride in telling you that. I am not, I'm not that guy. I got no respect for that guy. I don't believe that there's any reason ever to behave that way. I don't even remember it, but that was me. I was there. I was the one. I repaid all her loyalty and courageousness by eventually getting a financial windfall and buying a beach house and telling her it was over. That marked the last year of my drinking. So I think about her. I think about in my sobriety, again, many years into recovery. I'm married now for 5 or 6 years, and I'm not going to meetings anymore. I'm not in recovery anymore. I don't have a daily prayer life. I'm not helping anybody. I'm unsponsored. I'm dry. And I think about the my wife, and we're married today, we eventually reconciled, but she got worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative because 10 years separated from alcohol, I was the same guy that I was with the loyal and courageous guy. Hypercritical, never happy, unsatisfied. I don't know about y'all, but I'm gifted with the burden of insight. Like, I have a crystal clear recognition of exactly what you're doing wrong. And I would think the only loving thing to do is to let you know about that. So it's a party living with me, drunk or sober. And that's all I have to say about that.
Okay. All right. I'm Lennon. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is May 30th, 1995. My sponsor is Michael Arl. It is a female alcoholic. And my home group is Big Book and Gent here in Norfolk. And, you know, it's really hard for me to relate to this paragraph. I was not married when I got sober. And I'm not a man, so I don't have a wife. But on the other hand, I was... What do they call it? I am this secret and exciting affair with the girl who understands that I am that. That's what I ended up in my last couple of years of sobriety. That's where my drinking took me, and you know, I don't know what my thinking was. I was like, well, if he's married, he's not going to ask, you know, not going to demand a lot of things. He's not going to follow up on me and know how much I drink or whatever. I don't know what it was, you know, but for whatever reason, you know, I had several affairs at the end of my drinking that I wasn't too proud of. And you know, and they were long-term affairs, and it was really, really ugly. And I you know, went to my sponsor and, you know, told her how I wanted to, you know, seek these men out and, you know, make amends. And that was my intention. And she was like, absolutely not. That is stalking. You do not get to contact them, you know. And then what she had me do, and this is really, really helpful. I still do it today. I still do it with any amends that I'm approaching today. Still do it with my sponsees today, but I write it out, you know, as if I can speak it to that person. And even if the time and place ever does come up where we just bump into each other on the street, which I'm sure is never going to happen, but if it did, I would be prepared that I did accept what my wrongs were. And, you know, my whole thing was, is how could it be adultery if you're not married? You know, I wasn't the married party. I didn't really do that much damage. But, you know, what she had me look at, and she had me break it down. She said, well, not only did you damage, you know, yourself and your own self-esteem, but you weren't, you know, his, the wife, the children, you know, and you go on, you know, I mean, the whole family unit. And so, I mean, there was a lot of damage. It was, and this is really, really embarrassing. This was stuff I was going to take to my grave. I was just like, you know, I'm not going to talk about this ever in AA. And so, of course, I end up doing a panel. Thanks, David. And, but the thing is that it was really hard. Somewhere between 6 and 9 months of sobriety, he started contacting me. And I was living down in Hilton Head. I was down in South Carolina. He was living up in Maryland. And he started contacting me. It was everything that I could do to not return the phone calls. And I was just like, but, you know, what if he wants to get sober and he knows that? You know, it's like I was just making up all kinds of excuses. I just really, really wanted to get in there and stir things up. And, you know, I'm really grateful that my sponsor would absolutely not let me have any contact with him whatsoever. You know, maybe your sponsor would do differently, but I think in my case and all the information that we had, you know, that Bob was better off left alone. Anyway, that's all I have on that. Thanks.
Thanks. Next reading is on page 82. We start with, if we have no such complication, there is plenty we should do at home. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs to do is keep sober. Certainly he must keep sober, for there will be no home if he doesn't. But he is yet a long way from making good to the wife or parents for whom, for years, he is so shockingly treated. Passing all understanding is the patience mothers and wives have had with alcoholics. Had this not been so, many of us would have no homes today, would perhaps be dead. The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken, sweet relationships are dead, affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. He is like the farmer who came up out of his cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarked, don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand? The wind stopped blowing.
Yeah, I'm the unthinking man who, it took me a long time for some of this stuff to, and we'll talk about it more in the next paragraph, for some of this stuff to really kind of land with me. One of my innermost self thoughts was that, you know, really drinking and drugging are the problem, you know. I can see how crack is not going to further my career. You know, I'm not a dummy, you know. I know if I crack the seal on that whiskey, I'm not going to work tomorrow. And I'd never been able, you know, I couldn't, my blood alcohol level was higher than my grade point average. So eventually they ask you to leave, you know. So I'm not getting anywhere, and it's obviously because of the drinking. So when I stopped drinking, and I'm a guy, I know there's people in AA, you know, I've heard people from the podium, I drank a fifth of vodka every day for 35 years, you know, I never thought about stopping, you know, and not me, man. I quit. I wanted to quit. I drank the fun out of drinking by the time I was about 20. You know, I wasn't getting that ease and comfort and release, and it was all problems, you know, and I could be just as miserable and frightened and scared and upset drunk as I am, you know, sober. So I'm not getting anything out of the deal anymore, and I wanted to stop. And the collateral damage around drinking was getting, you know, way beyond what I wanted to pay on a daily basis. And it was just, you know, it was awful. It was like a full-time job, you know, that you had to go to that you don't want to go to. It was awful. So I quit a lot. And I'd quit for 6 weeks, 6 months, quit a year one time, you know, without AA. Just because deep down I think that drinking's the problem. Problem is, I'm so miserable sober, I'm going to eventually drink, you know. I didn't know any of that. But I was the unthinking man when I got sober. I kind of wanted a medal, you know. I kind of wanted you to pat me on the back, you know. Attaboy, we know, David, we know how hard this world is for you, and what a special little snowflake you are, and how tender your feelings are, and how you really need medication that hasn't been invented yet. And you've been just poor bastard. You've been out there trying to find through, you know, whatever means you can possibly stumble across to just feel a little better. We know how hard it is, you know. Nobody took that position. I took that position. Nobody would agree with me, you know. So it took me a long time, but it talks about passing all understanding as the patience that mothers and wives. I mean, I think about my mother, and we'll do more in the next paragraph, but that poor lady just, you know, I wouldn't go to school. My old man left when I was about 12. I thought that was why I was such a mess, but I was the oldest of three kids, so I'm 15 years old. I'm bigger than I am right now, and taller. I've shrunk. And that frame, you know, in a 15-year-old who thinks he's the man of the house, you know, it's ridiculous. But my poor mother, she couldn't get me to go to school. She couldn't get me to do anything, really. And if I wanted to talk, it was time to talk, you know. And she closed the door on me one time. Go to bed, David, you're drunk. And I kicked the door off the frame of her bedroom. You know, I mean, this is the kind of stuff I'm up to. This is me. So I am the tornado roaring through the lives of others. And you will pay attention to me when I want attention, you know. And then I get sober and I think, aren't you proud of me? Not so much, right? Thanks.
You know, in the last 6 months of my drinking, you know, I didn't, you know, I wasn't doing a whole lot of partying. I had these two little butt spots on my couch that I'd sit in, and I'd play Pat Benatar, singing Hell is for Children. And I would write these letters to Oprah Winfrey, telling her how miserable my life was, because I knew that there was something wrong with me. I did not know it was alcoholism. I thought that this is just the only way I can cope with my issues. I was writing these letters. And none of the letters ever got mailed, but some of them I would read the next day, and they would be all slurry handwriting, and it was just an awful, awful, lonely existence. And I thought, this is clear as day. I thought, I'm not hurting anybody but myself. Absolutely, I'm not hurting anybody but myself. You know, my family is living away in another, they're living up in Virginia, I'm down in South Carolina, I'm not hurting anybody. I don't know anything about these blackout calls that I'm making to people and, you know, telling them, you know, I mean, whatever you do in a blackout, I mean, some of them, you know, I mean, you know, can be pretty scary things. You'd be threatening suicide, you'd be, you know, making stuff up and that your life is just horrible. You'd be trying to get money out of people. I mean, I don't even know. I don't know. I was in a blackout. I was a blackout drinker. I drank every night to a blackout. And, you know, so I was causing a lot of damage, but I wasn't, you know, my family wasn't speaking to me when I got sober, and they didn't speak to me or have anything to do with me for almost 2.5 years. And so I didn't have to look at that right away, but I did have to look at it. And first of all, I thought that I didn't really have any selfishness, that I just really had a rough life. And that things, you know, nothing had been handed to me, and my whole family deserting me is probably why I drank so much anyway. You know, and I just had these tons of excuses, excuse upon excuse. I was just very, very selfish, self-centered, and inconsiderate, and I could see absolutely none of it, and especially when it came to my family. You know, they... I don't know if it was invented down in Hilton Head. I'm sure they have God boxes up here in Virginia. I've heard people talk of them, but they, you know, I had this God box, and I used to just stuff these letters, you know, because the guilt, you know, I would be going along, and I would be hearing somebody sharing something, especially in a meeting, and they would be talking about their families, and they were 6 months sober, and they were, like, doing these family events. And nobody in my family was talking to me, so I knew that I was doing something wrong. I would be ridden with guilt, and I would just go home, and I would just write these letters and keep stuffing them in that God box and stuffing them in the God box. And I just knew that I was supposed to be quiet until they wanted to have some. They did not have a restraining order out on me, but it was pretty close. I mean, they were like, don't call us again. I had a couple of restraining orders out on me, but just not my family. And so I knew that I was just not welcome. And I, you know, had to keep writing those letters and stuffing them in the God box. And you know, it must have worked, because not once did I have to drink over those resentments I had over those people that wouldn't talk to me that I owed amends to. If that makes sense. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Lynn.
Great. All right, the next reading is going to come from page 83. We'll start with, yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fit the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindness, and love. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not to urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone.
Our behavior will convince them more than our words. You don't hear it around too much, but or maybe you do. I don't know. Maybe I'm not listening anymore. But people used to say, you know, all my life, I wanted the world to judge me by my intentions. And the world continues to judge me by my actions, which I find patently unfair. You know, I didn't mean to steal from you. I didn't mean to lie to you. I wanted to come to work, you know. But you actually want me to show up when I say I'm going to show up. You want me to do the things that keep my promises, etc. So this long period of construction is ahead of us. And it's telling me to take the lead. My sponsor was very clear. You know, I was another thing that used to float around a lot was this idea of living amends. And my first sponsor was like, yeah, you're doing direct amends, David. And then you're going to learn how to practice these principles in all your affairs. You know, that's what you're going to do. I think a lot of people, I wanted to make a case for the living amends, you know, because I didn't really want to do the direct amends. And the remorseful mumbling that we're sorry, you know, he gave me the greatest gift on these amends, and it's a very simple framework, and it has never failed me. He basically said, David, you're done being sorry. Mm-hmm. Now you get to go be wrong. And that, I know how painful that is for people like me, but I'm wrong. You know, because my idea for an apology is, hey man, I really shouldn't have done that to you, but here's why you were such a jerk that I had to be, you see, you know. So I'm gonna make you wrong and to justify my behavior if you allow it. So even if your defects are glaring, I lied to you. That was wrong. I treated you unfairly. I failed to consider you. I'm here to make that right if I can. When I showed up in front of my mom, she did not want to discuss all this. You know, my mom has this incredible ability to see only the good, remember only the good. You know, my old man never forgot one single infraction. But my mom, I'll bring something up today, and my mom's like, oh, I don't remember that. You know, I mean, she sees the world in a very pleasant way. And so she didn't want to talk about all that stuff. She said, David, I am glad you're doing well. And I've only ever wanted you to be happy. And just keep doing what you're doing. And I thought being selfish and self-centered, I really felt like I got away with something there. She doesn't want the money. And then kind of on the way out, she said, by the way, though, I would like it if you'd return my phone calls. So 29 years later, my mom's still alive. That phone rings, and I can hear that in my ear just like it was yesterday. Mm-hmm. Hey, Ma. And I know she's going to tell me about the weather in Richmond. You know, and I know that it's not that different than Norfolk, you know, but... Mm-hmm. Anyway, I take her calls, you know, and the previous paragraph talked about selfish and inconsiderate habits, you know, have kept the home in turmoil, right? So we're not even talking about drinking. We're talking about selfishness and lack of consideration. So on this long road of reconstruction ahead, there's some things that I can practice. I can practice consideration. I can think about you. When I think about my mom, if I just devote 1 second to crawl out of my skull and all the important stuff that's swirling around there in any given moment and just think about my mom, she's got health problems, she's going to the doctor next week, she's got some surgery coming up, she was worried about that, she's got a thing going with my sister. You know what, why don't I call her? All I gotta do is think about her for about 10 seconds and then I pick up the phone and I call her and I say, hey Ma, I got nothing on my mind, I was just thinking about you. You'd think I hung up the moon. Oh, David, I'm just delighted that you called. What's the weather there? You know, I mean, but I can almost hear her telling her friends, I talked to my son today. He's the pepe, pepe, pepe. You know, I mean, why would I deprive her of that, you know? But it takes the practice of consideration on this long road. And then if you want to call living amends, asking each morning in meditation that God show me the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love, I'll get on with that, because love is an action I've been taught around here. Love's not a feeling. Love is a doing thing. I'm taking an action on your behalf because I love you. I'm doing something for you because I love you. If I'm starting to treat the world that way, then these things start to reconstruct. When I showed up in front of my brothers and sisters, it was a very simple thing. It's like, I've been a fallen down drunk thinking about only myself. I've been a lousy brother to you. I'd like to do better. You know, what can I do? You know? And they don't want to talk about it either. But they're interested in my behavior, not my words. You know, I've been sorry all my life, right? There was something in there. Did we do the... No, we didn't do the. There may be some wrongs. We may have never fully right. Okay, so I'm grasping at straws, so I will pass. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. I like the part where it starts out, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead, because that's what my recovery has been, is that it has definitely been reconstruction, tearing down, starting from zero base. And one of the very first things I had to do, especially with, because we're making reference to family here, is that I have this tone of voice. I don't know if you own it, but I have this tone of voice that I can use with my family that I would never use on a stranger. And for some reason or other, I'm just like, what? You know, what? Like I said the words, but it's this tone of voice, and it's a very, very, you know, so I have a way of being able to articulate that I'm really, really unhappy, and that, you know, that nobody in the family is pleasing me or giving me enough respect or giving me enough recognition, whatever it is, that I can use that tone of voice. And I cannot believe that it's been eliminated. Now, I hope I don't use it tomorrow because I said it's been eliminated, but it's almost been completely removed. At 5 years of sobriety, I moved back up here to Virginia, and so I was around my family full time. And I found myself at a family event, and at this time I'm probably 5 or 6 years sober, and I'm at a family event, and my mom is bragging. She's doing this bragging thing. My mom married an abusive alcoholic, and, you know, he abused me, he was, you know, he drank, you know, terrorized us kids, you know, and my mom's just bragging about this wonderful mother that she was, and, you know, how she raised all these great kids, and all this kind of stuff, and I was just like, oh, yeah, and I just used my very clever tone of voice, and I go, yeah, look at how good we all turned out, we're all really, you know, effed up, you know, and I don't think I said the effed up, but, you know, I mean, that was the gist of what I said, and I made my mother cry, and I mean, not just crying, it was like running out of the room crying, and I'm just like, oh my God, look at the trauma, you know, I just rolled my eyes, I had absolutely no sympathy for her, and, you know, I was really, really embarrassed of my behavior. You know, I got home and I called my sponsor and told him myself. I didn't correct my behavior that night. It was my brother went and comforted her. And my sponsor, you know, told me that I needed to make an amends for my behavior. And I go, well, so what do I got to do? Write it out? You know, I'm like, not ready to do this. And she's like, yeah. So anyway, I wrote it out. I did what I was supposed to do. I did my assignment. I called her back and I read it to her. And she said, you know what? That's pretty good, but you're going to delete about this part. And what I want you to do is just say to her exactly, besides the fact that you were wrong, that you shouldn't have said that or done that, what I would like for you to add is what type of daughter you want to be to her. And I added that in, and then I called her back and read it back to her. And she said, okay, it's good to go. I want you to go ahead and do that this afternoon. Can you do that today? Can you do it tomorrow? And I said, I don't think I can do this in person. And I really didn't, I still had so much anger over the fact that she had married my dad and he'd abused me. You know, I just couldn't get over that. And so, what I did is, I settled on the fact that I was going to give it to her in person, but it was written. So I had this stack of things that I took up to my mother's house, and I gave it to her. And normally she would take the stack of things, just lay it there, and just never, you know, like a week later, pick it up and look at it, look through the stack of stuff. But for some reason or other, she rifled through it, found the envelope. You know how much I love cards. I'm so excited. I want to open up the card. And I go, Mom, later on, after I leave. And she was just insistent. And she just stood there and she read the card. And she read the card in front of me. And for the first time in a really long time, my mom hugged me. And she told me that she was really sorry that she couldn't have been a better mother, or that she couldn't have been stronger as a mother when we were growing up. That's not what I expected out of that transaction. I expected just to get out of there unscathed and not have to talk to my mom. And, you know, the thing is that that changed. That moment changed our lives. That changed our relationship. And I'm just, you know, I'm just really, really grateful for this process. You just never, ever know how it's going to work out. You know, you always think it's about deflating our egos, and I never, ever expected to hear anything back from my mother. Anyway, thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you. We're still on page 83. This is the part you were thinking of, David, I think. There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. There may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone.
Yeah, I love Bill. Bill always tells me what to do, when to do it, and the attitude to bring to the task. And are you capable of being sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble? I wanted to clean up a couple of things from the other reading, where it's, that one line where it says we ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it. When I first came across that, I thought, oh, good, this is my chance to plead my case, you know. And my sponsor pointed out, it's like, no, the past as we now see it is the result of your four-step inventory when we found out how selfish and dishonest, self-seeking and frightened you are. That's how we now see the past. Oh, okay, well, that's different. And then I was thinking about the little piece, we shouldn't talk incessantly about spiritual matters. I was thinking about a moment that I had with my wife. This is in sobriety and after the reconciliation of the marriage. And she's going on about something. I don't know what it was, but I'm not paying attention to what she's talking about. And I'm just kind of shaving and looking in the mirror and trying not to cut myself. And she's like, about something. And I said, I just said, yeah, you might be suffering from a condition that only a spiritual experience will conquer. And then her 5 foot, all 5 feet of her showed up in the doorway and said, don't you ever whip that shit on me again. You know, I was like, yes, ma'am. So she didn't want to hear about this stuff at all. So there may be some wrongs we can never fully right. There's two things here. That girl that I did so wrong, the loyal and courageous gal, she was in a relationship by the time I got around to this amends. It wasn't appropriate for me to go look her up. I sent her an honest letter. Offered to do whatever I could to make it right. Acknowledged, you know, the way that I had treated her, and then I let her know that I wasn't living that way today, and she was kind enough to write me back, And basically, I'm glad you're doing well, you know. So how do you make that fully right, you know? I can't make that situation fully right. I can tell you that 6 years into sobriety, both of us were married. Her father passed away. And all I know is that she thought enough to call me and tell me. You know, I know that you were close with him. And I just wanted to let you know. I didn't get invited, but so that told just that simple thing told me that there was at least some healing there. There was still some recognition of affection, some recognition of the bond that we had, you know, in that very destroyed relationship. And there's peace today. Again, I have nothing but shame telling you that story, but I'm at peace with that today. With my father, I got to tell you about my father. With my father, I could not face him. When I used to tell this story, I'd say, anytime I sit down to talk to my father, one of us leaves in tears, you know? And the truth of that is the one of us was always me. Just sounded better the other way. And my father was living down in Florida. I worked with my sponsor. We decided a letter would be just fine, and he kind of helped me with the letter. But essentially, I sent the man a letter saying that I lied to you. You know, you tried to help me. I stole from you. I took money that you gave me for my education and spent it on dope. I embarrassed you in front of your friends. My father was a veterinarian, and he owned the business, and he had to fire his idiot son because his idiot son couldn't stay out of the kitty medicine. I'm a moron, you know. So I'm that, you know, when I think about it, that must have been kind of embarrassing for him. although I had to be sober to even give that any consideration, you know. So anyway, I wrote him this letter and I asked him, I said, listen, I said, I'm not asking for your forgiveness. I'm not asking anything, but I was petrified that it would be treated like everything else in my family was treated. We'd just ignore it, never mention it again. And I was afraid that I mailed that letter and we'd never discuss it, you know. So I asked him, I said, I'm not asking for your forgiveness. Just please acknowledge that you read these words. So he writes me back a letter that says, David, his opening remark, I can't remember all of it, but I remember him saying, I remember the beginning and I remember the ending. He said, David, you always give me the hardest tasks. That's an opening line. And basically the way that he closed it was he said, I don't know how much longer I'm going to live, but how about you and I go for the good from here on out? And I got that letter and it didn't mean much to me at the time. I really kind of wanted him to admit his faults. I wanted him to, you know, gush over about how desperately he loved and cared for me. You know, I still have selfish, self-seeking motives. So I thought maybe I did it wrong, or maybe he's just the defective guy I've always suspected him of being. But that became a contract between he and I. And I would go down to visit him down in Florida, and he'd be halfway through a half a gallon of early times, better times with early times. And he'd start in on me. He'd start engaging in the Francis family sport, which is ridicule. Mm-hmm. And so he would start in on me. Remember that thing you screwed up that time, you know? And I'd say, oh, Pop, I thought we agreed we were going to put all that behind us. And even whiskey couldn't cut through that. That's a spiritual contract that we now had. I'd say, I thought we agreed to put that all behind us, Pop. He'd say, right you are, lad. Right you are. And not a harsh word passed between us. And when that man died, we were friends. We were good friends. He trusted me to make his arrangements for him to see that everything worked out. And because of you people, and because of 12 steps, at his funeral, I watched my sister, over-medicated, make it all about her. You know, I could be her. That's me. I saw my brother angry. And I knew that I could be his son in that environment. And I thought, well, what would he want his son to do? And I thought he'd want his friends to feel welcome. And so I just started going around to his friends and saying, hey, thanks for coming. My old man, he told me a story about you and he going fishing that one time. And wasn't it Clink that fell over the side of the boat that time? Yeah. Oh, man, he loved that story. You know, my dad thought so much of you. Thank you so much for coming. And I got to be his son, not play the role of the devastated child, you know. And none of that came from me. Mm-hmm. None of that comes from my nature. I want it to be all about me. So that amends, as pitiful as that little letter was, absolutely started, like Lynn was talking about, it started us on a long road of reconstruction that was really very easy to do. It was very easy to be that man's friend. Somehow letting him off the hook got me off the hook. I didn't need an apology from him. I didn't need an acknowledgement from him. He never admitted he was wrong about anything to his dying day to me, but it didn't matter. I didn't need it anymore. I didn't want it anymore. I just wanted to be his son. Yeah, that's what I meant to say. Thanks.
Okay. And moving on, I'm just going to talk a little bit more about how, you know, how these amends worked. And there are so many wrongs that I could not fully right because I'm a blackout drinker, you know. And until you bring it up to me, and then I'm still going to sit there and go, you know what, I still don't remember it. But I will honestly make an amends to somebody if they're going to bring it up to me face to face now. But when my my mother came and gave me my 7-year medallion, I was a member of the Saturday morning brunch luncheon, and they just loved her there. Everybody just embraced her. She just loved AA. She just stood up there and said something about the fact that she doesn't have to be afraid to answer the phone at 2:30 in the morning ever again. And, you know, and that just really struck me. I was just like, you know, what an idiot. Why was I doing that? Why? Who the heck gets drunk and calls their mom up? You know, and I was a 30-year-old woman, and, you know, calling up my mommy because I was drunk. But, you know, that, when she said that, it really struck me profoundly. It became a lot easier for me to make amends. So much that here I am, I'm 45, you know, time goes by, 45 years old, I'm working in this job. My mom's calling my job every day. She's gotten to know everybody there. She just loves everybody. She's sitting at home. She's this retired housewife, and she's like, you know, chit-chatting on the phone with all my coworkers. And I'm going, Mom, I'm in my 40s, leave me alone. And then I finally had to set these parameters. I'm going, you're going to have to stop calling me at work, you know, between 10 a.m. and 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You cannot call me. You know, it's not appropriate. And so, you know, the very next day she calls me, and it's like 12 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm slammed. I just couldn't, you know, I said, Mom, I asked you not to call me. I said, I'm going to have to hang up now. I love you. Goodbye. And I hung up on her, and she goes, you know, she was trying to pick a fight with me. She was trying to egg me on. So anyway, 2 days go by. I called up my sponsor that night, told me, and she goes, oh, okay, well, you know, whatever. She said, no, you do not have to call your mom and make an amends. And so 2 days later, my mom calls me up, and she says, she said, Lynn, I've been waiting for you to call me, because normally every time we get in a fight, you have to call me up and apologize, and I know that you need to do that to stay sober. So I was waiting for your phone call. And she hadn't gotten it, and she was so distraught. She was worried about me. And I said, no, Mom. I said, this time Michael said no. I actually didn't hang up on you, Mom. I had a very short conversation with you. But we're going to have to stop talking during working hours. But, you know, right now my mom has dementia. And I don't know if anybody's had any experience with dementia, but just bring you up to date. You know, you know, she gets disoriented. She's living in her house that she's lived in since 1969. And she thinks she's in a vacation timeshare, and she wants to check out. And, you know, she's got all kinds of antics and all kinds of things, and I'm just like, okay, well, you know, I was calling her at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I guess I'm running over there again, and I'm taking care of stuff, and I'm having this ongoing relationship with my mother and her dementia. And you know, the other day, she was really, really picking on me in front of this workman that we had in there repairing her heating unit. And you know, I just got kind of nasty, kind of snippy with her, and I felt really badly about it. And so the next day I was like, Johnny on the spot, I'm going to call her up and make amends right away. And I called her up, and she goes, we didn't even have a problem with the heat yesterday. I have no idea what you're talking about. So The good thing is now she doesn't even remember what she's pissed off at me about, so I can just keep making those amends, and she's gracious enough to, she goes, but I think it's okay that we're talking. She goes, I think we're getting along really well. And the weird thing is she finally flipped at me and flipped out the other day and looked at me and looked at me and started referring to me in the third person. She's talking to me about me. So she said, I want you to know that you can leave. You can stop coming over here now because my daughter comes over here every day and she takes really good care of me. Anyway, you just never ever know how the stuff with these reconstructive periods are going to work out. And I'm really grateful for that. Thanks.
One more reading and we'll wrap things up. It's on page 83 as well. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.
Yeah, we're short on time. These are the promises. I had a sponsor that, and we're all familiar with them because we read them a lot. Because alcoholics love these things because we get stuff. You know, it sounds like it feels pretty good, doesn't it? You know, new freedom, new happiness, woohoo! But my sponsor would always, if you asked him to read it, he'd say these are the promises that come after the ninth step, which is where they are in the literature and what we've been talking about tonight. And I think "we think not" is the least quotable line in that whole narrative. Wouldn't it be great if we were like, if we were painstaking? You know, because we're feel-good junkies, right? I mean, who wants to take the pain of showing up in front of people being wrong and paying the money back and doing what we got to do, you know, to clear up the past, right? If we're painstaking. So we got to do these things. The other thing that I got to say about this is these are symptoms of a spiritual experience. These are remarkable things that happen if we do these nine steps. It's also the perfect place to stop doing AA. I've seen people do it. I've done it. I've got my new freedom. I got my new happiness. I got my new job, got my new relationship, got my little duckies in a row. Thanks, AA. And I'm out of here. And then I get to experience alcoholism again. Maybe I drink, maybe I don't. But what happened to me was I didn't make the turn from 9 into 10, 11, and 12 as a daily way of living. I got to sit in front of Bob Darrell this weekend, and he used a phrase that I just love. Every time I think of it, it delights me. He identified himself as, I'm an everyday AA. I'm an everyday AA. Thanks.
Are we done?
No, you got a couple minutes.
Oh, okay. I love the promises. I love the fourth dimension, you know, all of these great things that happen to us that transform us. The feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. The one right after that, we will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Over the last couple of years, I've spent a lot of time being sick. And when you spend a lot of time sick, you lay around, you know. You go and you get your cancer treatment and come home and you just be sick, you know. And you know, the wonderful thing that happens that we get such a... Oh, I mean, we're just so lucky. The wonderful thing that happens is when you belong to this program, the phone rings, you know, and it's like, I don't want to bother you. you know, it's like, you know, because I've sponsored people, I've been sponsoring people, you know, since I've been sober. And so some of my sponsees have had for a long time, you know, and it's like, you know, they call me up and then they get me out of myself. And then I just, then I feel so much better. It's like I was laying around feeling really, really sucky and really bored with selfish and self-centered things anyway. I get really bored with my stuff. And, you know, I would much rather listen to somebody else's stuff. And you know, what it does is it pulls me out of myself. And it's just such a miracle. That phone ringing, please don't. Especially the girls up here that call me a lot. Don't stop calling me. It saves my life. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you. All right, we're going to pass this seventh tradition basket now. Let me read this self-support card. The seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup central office, local offices, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help alcoholic who still suffers. Although the amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world, we may want to remember that a dollar does not support as many services as it used to. Are there any AA-related announcements? Okay.
Saturday the 26th, my home group, Sick and Twisted, is having a supper and a speaker meeting. The meeting starts at 10, and there's food at 8:45. That's Saturday the 26th. Yeah.
Thanks.
All right.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Anyone else?
I really hope this story takes.
Announcements?
Okay.
Let's see.
Yeah. Candlelight will not be having a meeting this Friday. We'll be having a NEST program, so we will not be there.
Thanks. Amy?
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Amy.
Hi, Amy.
The principal's group is celebrating the anniversary a week from tomorrow night. David Francis, if you didn't get enough of him tonight, and who could? He will be seeing him.
I can't.
He will be
the can't get enough of him.
Any other announcements? Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Is anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? I'd like to welcome you. Yes.
I'm Stephanie, I'm an alcoholic.
Stephanie, welcome.
I'm Liz, I'm an alcoholic addict.
Hi, Liz.
Welcome. All right, you've got literature available on the table over here. If you'd like to purchase any literature, just see me or any home group member after the meeting. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, I will be available at this table after we close the meeting. Please feel free to come up and talk to me. Reminder, smokers, please use the butt can outside and provided and stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. In closing, can we thank the panel again? Please thank Lynn and David.
Thank you, Lynn.
Thanks to all who participated. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the steps discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol on Colonial, right before the train tracks. And would anyone like to read the last two paragraphs on 164? Grant?
I'm Grant, I'm an alcoholic.
G Money.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Amen.
We'll now close the door to prayer.
That eight on the finger. That's how you run a meeting, Maddie.
Oh, we did it. Yeah. It's just like, it's not always happening. They always hate you. Never mind. Here.
Our Father. Who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory,